Good morning. It is 8:06 on this Thursday, December 4th. I'm Christine Weller, filling in for Leslie Thatcher on the local news hour. As far as traffic at the moment, we are starting to see some slowdowns on Kimball Junction, on I-80 toward Kimball Junction and toward 189. So be aware of that. Some slowdowns on Kearns Boulevard as well. So if you're coming into town, just know there's some traffic. As for the weather, it is 11 degrees Fahrenheit in Park City at the moment. The high is 32. And over in the Heber area, it is 21 degrees with a high of 36. With a more in-depth weather update, here's ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Happy Thursday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back. Well, we've got quiet conditions today with some clouds on the increase. Temperatures climbing to near freezing in Park City. We'll see those highs only in the mid-30s for us in the Heber Valley. A winter storm targets the area as we go throughout your Thursday night into your weekend. So that means that, yes, as we go into overnight Thursday into Friday morning, we expect a period of snow to develop, and that snow could reach down to the valley floors here. So, yes, looks like we'll be waking up to some snow falling and potential some light accumulations here for the Wasatch Back as we go into the morning hours. Temperatures will be only around 20 degrees, and then we'll see off and on chances of snow for Park City throughout the day with some heavier snow arriving Friday night into early Saturday morning. The Heber Valley will see that snow during your Friday morning, slowly potentially mixing with some rain by the time we get towards your Friday afternoon. But either way, we've got winter storm watches that are in effect out there across the Wasatch Back. They start late tonight and will go through at least Saturday night for multiple rounds of some wintry weather that will lead to some significant accumulations for the first time this season. So prepare now for some messy commutes for your Friday morning commute, definitely for your Friday evening into your Saturday morning commutes, and a lot of folks heading up into the Wasatch Back with some opening ski dates coming up for us this weekend. Yeah, be aware, it's going to be a significant travel impact as we go throughout this weekend. We'll see that chance of snow continuing into your Saturday night before we go to more scattered snow showers as we move into your Sunday. Temperatures will stay on the chilly side throughout the weekend as well. Again, as we go into your Friday, highs will only be around freezing in Park City with highs in the upper 30s. In the Heber Valley, we'll be in the mid-30s for highs on your Saturday. As we get towards the Park City area, we'll be seeing those highs around 40 in the Heber Valley. And we stay that way for your Sunday as well. Heading into next week, we'll try to slowly dry things out, but we'll see those temperatures in the 40s for highs and lows well down into the 20s. That's a look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back on ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
And with a avalanche forecast here this morning, we've got Utah Avalanche Center forecaster Drew Hardesty on the phone with more conditions on the back in the backcountry. Welcome.
Hey, welcome. Thanks for having me. This is Bo Torrey with the Utah Avalanche Center.
Oh, hi, Bo.
And yeah, thanks for having me on. It's been no surprise. It's been a dry, slow start to the winter, but there is some snow up high, and we're really excited to see some snow in the forecast. Right now, we've got a moderate avalanche hazard on upper elevation, shady slopes. So that's west through north through east facing, above about 9,000 feet. Where the snow that hung around on October and November, it lingered and it transformed into a layer of facets. And the storm we had just last weekend wasn't a lot to tip the scales, but it was enough to start to see some avalanche activity and give us a preview of what we expect to see this weekend. And looking ahead with this wet and windy storm that we have on tap coming through tonight into the weekend, we can expect that our avalanche hazard is going to rise and our avalanche size is going to grow. We're encouraging people to, caution themselves as they're wanting to get out and get some early season turns for the first time. Hopefully many of the ski resorts will open up, but they can continue to check our weather and avalanche advisory at www.utahavalanchecenter.org.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us, Bo.
Thank you.
Heber City is heading into the next stage of renovating its Main Street Park. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports a design firm will draft ideas for the reimagined park's features.
The Heber City Council voted Tuesday to pay a contractor over $100,000 to design the next phase of changes to its Main Street Park. Design firm Terracon will come up with three concepts with a range of sizes for the proposed buildings and amenities in the future park. The plans would also include cost estimates. Heber City Manager Matt Brower said the council will go over the three designs at its retreat in late January.
And once you've blessed them, we will then take them out on the road, if you will, and get the feedback through various means from the public as to what they most support.
This phase comes more than a year after urban planning consultant Roger Brooks shared his vision to turn City Park into the most awesome square in the United States. His ideas for the two-block park include ice skating in the winter, a splash pad in the summer, pop-up spaces for small businesses, and a steady rotation of family activities. Terracon proposed three community open houses in February, where locals could see three-dimensional sketches of low, medium, and high-cost options of Roger Brooks's ideas. A preferred plan would be presented to the City Council in March. Some council members said there's already been plenty of public outreach. Councilmember Sid Ostergaard said he worries city leaders will, quote, keep on spinning our wheels instead of acting decisively.
Roger Brooks worked his butt off going out and researching and talking, and we did a lot of public outreach. My concern is we need the next step. We are just going around in circles right now.
He said the city needs to get a cost estimate, then apply for grant funding and get the plans done. Mayor Heidi Franco, however, said the city needs more public feedback to move forward.
We need an official survey that is going to reach out to the majority of the public that's statistically significant, because you are proposing to change the name of the park, which people love. You're proposing to change pretty much everything about that park, which people love.
Councilmember Yvonne Barney said she was reluctant to spend the money, but thought the contract would be worthwhile if locals could give meaningful feedback on more specific design plans.
If it gets us to the point where we have three options, where we really talk about it, take out the ice ribbon. Here it is with the ice ribbon. Here's a smaller ice ribbon. All of those things, I think that goes further with our public.
The contract was approved with a 4-1 vote. The city will spend $107,000 on the design phase, with up to $22,000 in contingency funds. Heber City is a financial supporter of KPCW. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
I've got Summit County Councilmember Tanya Hansen online with me. Tanya is here to share what was discussed in the 2026 budget at its most recent council meeting. Welcome, Tanya.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here.
Yes.
So the budget hearing last night discussed the longest item was Basin Rec, and which is proposing a 15% tax increase. The council delayed the vote on it to next week. Is that because the council was going to vote 2-2 on it?
That is correct. We had one council member missing, so there were four of us, and we were voting 2-2. But I need to clarify for people listening. Basin Rec is asking for a 15% increase. That is not on your entire tax bill. That is on the portion of the tax bill that reflects Basin Rec's expenditures on your tax bill. So that's really important, because if you think of your overall tax bill and 15%, that's huge, right? So they're asking for an increase of basically $1.3 million, which equates to, let me see here, $51.32 on a primary residence of the taxable value, not your total value, taxable value of $1.5 million. And for second homeowners, that equates to approximately $91.50 on a $1.5 million taxable residence. So, people need to be aware, when you think of a 15% on your tax bill, that's scary. But anyway, back to your question. Yes, we are continuing this until next Wednesday, 6 o'clock at the Colville Courthouse, so that we can have our five council members there and break that tie and move forward one way or another.
Okay, and council member Chris Robinson might have been able to join the meeting to break the deadlock, but the council mentioned they wanted him to listen to some of the public comment. Which concerns most persuaded you?
Well, for me, my position is I am really opposed to raising property taxes. I feel that we are taxing people out of our communities. Yeah, there's a lot of people who can afford it, who say $50 is nothing, but there's a lot of people that every dollar counts. And I'm opposed to raising property taxes. So that's my position. I don't know where Chris lies. I thought it was important for Chris to be able to hear the public comments last night, because all of the public comments were against raising this tax. So that's why we waited until next week, where he would have time to watch that video and listen to public comment to help him form his opinion.
Okay, and on December 10th, that's next Wednesday, that's when the vote will need to be taken on the budget. Will there be any chance for public comment at that meeting as well?
No, we have closed the public comment, but people can always email us. You know, our emails are online at Summit County. You can always email us and share your comments, your concerns, if you agree. So we're always looking at our emails and taking that information, but there'll be no public comment during that meeting.
Okay, good to know. And do you expect Basin Rec to revise its budget before then?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. So, you know, to be fair to Basin Rec, I'm a proponent of what they do. They do great work, okay? They have 2,500 acres of open space, 185 miles of trails, outdoor parks, tennis courts, pickleball, basketball, playgrounds, fields. They do great work. My concern is, at this time, people are just weary of paying taxes and increased taxes. And I think timing is everything, and it's just not the right time for us right now. But that, I'm only one vote, one voice.
Right. And I know that they do have two versions drawn up, Basin Rec does. One if there is a tax increase, and one if there's not. Are those the only two options? Are there any other routes that could be taken?
I don't think at this point, because of the process where we started with truth and taxation and a public hearing. So I think because we're in the middle of the process, I don't believe, and I would have to refer to our legal team on this, but I don't believe there's an opportunity to revise that at this point. That is something that if Basin Rec were interested in, they would need to follow up with our legal team on.
Okay. And what happens if the council doesn't approve it next week? Is that even possible? Because they do need...
No.
Okay.
We have to approve it. And if it's a 2-2 vote, we will not approve it. It will go to non-approval. So that's why that fifth person is really important.
Okay, that makes sense. And that meeting will be in Colville and on Zoom next week.
Correct.
As far as other things the council discussed, the council is going to take up the regular county budget next week. It approved budgets for Mountain Regional Water Company and the Park City Fire District. Are there any concerns there?
No, Park City Fire, you know, they have pretty much a flat budget. Their budget is $32 million. They manage it well. Their largest expenses are salaries, which is typical of any budgets, station expenditures, and capital. No truth in taxation, no increase there. Mountain Regional, their operating budget for 2026 is a little over $17 million. We did approve their budget last night, and there is a slight increase for water users that are affiliated with Mountain Regional. But I really liked their approach. So if instead of doing a fee across the board, they're doing it based on your water usage. So the folks who use the least amount of water, their water bill will see a 3% increase. And that's basically from $3.75 a gallon up to $3.85 a gallon. But those folks who use the most amount of water, they will see a 14% increase, which is still small. And that's from $34 per gallon up to $38.75 per gallon. So I really liked their approach on that. And we did approve that last night as well. Back to your question regarding the county budget, we will be approving that next week with more public comment taken on that from folks. We are not doing a truth in taxation. The budget is a little bit north of $100 million. But I think, you know, it's a very, very good budget. Public health is flat. There's a lot of good things that have happened in this budget. So I anticipate that we will approve that budget next week.
Okay, and is that one that also cannot change and must be approved next week?
That's correct.
Okay, good to know. And one thing that was struck from the county budget this year was the tax for service area 8. It's a fee for just a handful of residents far up Chalk Creek Road who are paying for the maintenance of the entire road from Wyoming to Colville. What are you hearing from neighbors about this?
Well, I happen to live on Chalk Creek Road, just so you know, but I'm not in service area number 8. I mean, there's like, I don't know, 8 to 12 residents that live in Upton in service area 8. The other people who contribute to that service area tax is oil and gas companies. Now, if we could carve them out and just have the oil and gas companies pay, I'm all for that. But unfortunately, legally, we can't do that. So a year ago, maybe two, the residents came to us and said, hey, this is not fair. We are paying a lot of tax. And they were, I mean, you know, they were paying, I don't know, $12,000-$15,000 a year for homes that are not assessed, you know, for that amount of money, but it just happened to be there in service area number 8. So they came to us and said, hey, this isn't fair. We need to look at this. And we agreed. And so the Public Works is taking on this cost and absorbing that cost into their budget to help offset this service area number 8 tax, so these folks won't pay those exorbitant taxes. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. Can you talk a little bit more about why the oil companies can't, why they can't pay for the road?
Well, I guess legally, anyone who is in a service area, you're all in it together, kumbaya, right? And you cannot just separate some people or some companies that might be able to afford a higher tax. That just isn't fair. So it's all or none. And that's unfortunate. Service area number 8 was created in the 70s during the big oil boom. So, you know, the tax that came from those oil companies and gas companies really offset all of the cost. But as time's gone on, there's been less production in that area. So the tax liability has swung not more, you know, the residents had to pick up more of that. So that's kind of the backstory on how this happened.
Okay. Yeah. Is service going to decrease at all along Chalk Creek with the change in who's paying for this?
We don't believe so. We think that the future budget, the public works budget, can absorb that and take care of that. It's been a very, very well-maintained road, which it's needed to be, because even today, there are oil trucks that go up and down this road, and they cause a lot of wear and tear. But we think that our public works can take care of this budget.
Okay, great. The council also discussed the Meals on Wheels program at the jail during budget talks. Why is the jail taking this on? And tell us a little bit more about who it serves.
So the Meals on Wheels program is a great program, and it's a program that delivers meals to mostly seniors in need in our community that, you know, don't get out and they need some help with meal service. It's a really great program. And that is through Mountain Lands Association. And I don't know who was providing those meals prior to them approaching our jail and saying, hey, can you take these meals on and just do the food preparation for it? And then we'll have our delivery people pick it up and deliver to those in need. And the jail did take that on. And I haven't had this experience, and I look forward to it. But apparently the food in the jail is really, really good. So They're providing the meals, and I think the hard cost on that is $4.50 a meal, and Mountain Lands is paying us, you know, $5 and some change. So there is a little bit of revenue opportunity there for the county.
Okay, awesome. That is everything I wanted to ask. Is there anything else you think our listeners should know?
No, I think that's it. I mean, if people are really interested in this budget process and where your tax dollars are going, it's important to show up at the meetings or to at least Zoom in to be aware of where your tax dollars are going.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay. Have a great day. Bye.
You too. We've been speaking with Summit County Councilmember Tanya Hansen on the 2026 budget. A new parking garage at Canyons won't be ready for Park City Mountain's opening day, but plenty more parking abounds. KPCW's Connor Thomas has what you need to know to make it up the mountain on day one.
The new parking garage going up in the Cabriolet lot is slated to open mid-December. That means it won't be ready for Park City Mountain's season kickoff, December 5th, but when the first two levels are ready, they'll be free this season. The next three levels will be built next summer. Most of the rest of Canyon's Village parking will be free this season. Only the uppermost lot at the bottom of High Mountain Road will have a fee. It'll be $29 from 8:30 a.m. until noon and free after that. Cars with four or more people park free all day. Over on the Mountain Village side, parking will be $29 and require a reservation from day one. All Mountain Village surface lots are free and first come, first served after noon. Cars with four or more occupants can park free in the first-time lot, but they still need an advance reservation. The odd lot out is the underground Mountain Village garage, which is $50 and always requires reservations. At Deer Valley Resort, which opens for season pass holders December 5th and the public on the 6th, parking in the snow park lot remains free this season. Once East Village lifts begin spinning, there will be 1,200 free spots there, too. New this year, most skiers must pay to park at the Jordanelle Gondola. It's still free for season pass holders or cars with three or more people. Deer Valley hasn't said how much the lot will cost. Season pass holders must register for a parking pass. As always, transit to both ski areas and around Park City and Summit County is free. High Valley Transit's 109 Snowball Express bus starts running from the Jeremy Ranch and Ecker Hill Park and rides to Canyons and Mountain Village again on December 7th. The transit agency teased on social media that a certain North Pole resident in a red suit will be at the wheel. Deer Valley Resort and Vail Resort's Epic Promise Foundation are financial supporters of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
And here's KPCW's Leslie Thatcher. She spoke with Leadership Park City Director Scott Van Hartisfelt about what the class will learn on their 2026 city tour to Vail and Breckenridge.
Leadership Class 32 will be headed to Colorado for the annual city tour this spring. On the phone with details is Leadership Park City Executive Director Scott Van Hartisfelt. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Doing great. Thank you. So the decision has been made to head to Vail and Breckenridge at the end of May. When was the last visit to these locations? Do you recall?
I do. It's a great question. We were last in Vail in 2014. We were last in Breckenridge in 2015. Both of those trips were notable for a lot of different reasons. We were actually, our group was traveling in Vail in 2014 when news broke that Vail had purchased Park City Mountain Resort. So they were in Vail as that happened, working with some of the local officials there. And then in Breckenridge, my local Sunrise Rotary was actually, we had two members of Sunrise Rotary that were on that tour, and they observed these crazy people in Breckenridge doing a long shot ski down Main Street. And it's a great example of why we do city tour. They brought that back and developed the Sunrise Rotary annual shot ski fundraiser that we to this day compete with Breckenridge to set a world record. That was born on city tour in 2015.
Yeah. So how is it that you kind of decide which resort towns you're going to go to just based on how many years it's been since you last been there? Or
that is one of the determining factors. We want to make sure that there's a lot that has changed and a lot of development that has happened in the period since our last visit so that we have new things to learn and new things to experience. Also, geographically, we draw what used to be about a 7-hour bus ride circle around Park City to make sure that we don't put people on buses for too long. Last year, we put class 31, who was very patient with me, we put them on a bus ride to Tahoe and to Reno, which was a little bit outside of that window. But that draws the circle for us. And then beyond that, it's just where we feel like we have a lot to learn and a lot to understand.
Yeah. So what have you got lined up in both Vail and Breckenridge at this point, or is that what you're going to be working on?
We are working on it right now. We've worked with we have an organizing committee that we've established in both of those destinations. Both of them are really excited to work with the Park City team. I can tell you that Park City's reputation as a really vibrant community and a community that is working hard on sustainability and growing what life is like here, that reputation travels. And so people are equally interested, not just to share what they're working on, but to learn from our team as well. So the Vail team and the Breck team were both very excited. In Breckenridge, they have some interesting things going on. They have a publicly funded public-private partnership on something called Breck Create, which is their own art district that has been established and successful here for a number of years. They are doing really progressive work on housing, on childcare, and on sustainability. And then something that actually caught my eye, Breckenridge has a very similar central corridor, Main Street corridor to Park City. And they have a similar issue, or had a similar issue, with food delivery trucks parking on Main Street and kind of clogging up traffic and clogging up parking for that main tourism corridor. So they developed a central delivery site in partnership with all of their restaurants, where all food deliveries for all of the restaurants in town come into a central warehouse and then are distributed with golf carts, believe it or not, to the individual restaurants on a daily basis. Interesting, kind of something for us to explore and take a look at. So that personally kind of caught my eye. And then in Vail, they have quite a bit going on as well. They have two massive housing projects that they have just that are either complete or almost complete, totaling $380 million. So really progressive things that they're doing with housing. And now they are kind of faced with questions about how they manage that housing and how they manage people who, how they want to bring workforce and others into that space. They have a $54 million reimagination of their ice arena. So they're looking at some of their older infrastructure and thinking about how they can reimagine and invest in that older infrastructure to create new and vibrant spaces for their community. And then something that is near and dear to my heart, the town manager, his name is Russell Forrest, is really passionate about this panel of young and emerging leaders that he's established. He calls them next gen leaders. And he has leaned into them to help steer the kind of the civic direction and provide a voice of these emerging generations and these emerging leaders and some of the important decisions that they're making as a community.
All right. So I think, I guess this is probably your third or fourth city tour. I mean, have you found these city tours helpful? I mean, is it something as the new director that you envision worth continuing?
Across the board, I have found them really transformational, not just for, and it is important to say, in each city tour, I think that there are really important things that we bring back to the community, back to Park City. Lessons that we've learned, both on things that we should do and kind of cautionary tales on projects that may be in our future and how to better manage those projects to success. So I think the base promise of City Tour is that we're going to be in these destinations. We are going to integrate with their local stakeholders and bring some of those lessons back to Park City. I think that in every single tour I've been on, that has happened. In addition to that, you have this wonderful opportunity where you are taking not just the class, and the class is dynamic. We have people from all over our community, 35 members of the class this year, 36 members of the class this year that'll be on the traveling tour. But we're also always joined by most of our elected officials. We're joined by members of the chamber and the DMO. We're joined by members of the Community Foundation and Basin Recreation, just kind of a broad representation in the community that travel together. And as they are viewing these similar problems, but out of context, out of Park City's own, you know, personal dynamics, they're able to build relationships with each other. And I think that those relationships go a long way to carrying solutions-oriented conversations once they get home.
Yeah. 36 class members, that's big. I guess, how is it that you decide who are the additional people that get to join you?
There are, I don't know how scientific the process is. We certainly start with offering those spaces to our partners and our stakeholders. So our stakeholders include the city and the county. We're really excited when we're able to welcome senior members of city and county government, including our elected officials on these tours. It is a wonderful opportunity for them, but it's also an opportunity, think about it, for the class. The class gets an opportunity to see these people out in the world, right? To ask questions of, you know, try being on a bus ride for 6 hours with Chris Robinson. You will learn a tremendous amount about land in the West and that experience in ways that it's a masterclass. So we love having members of the city and county with us. In addition to that, we have really important stakeholders that have supported the program and who are kind of linchpins of the community. So they always are invited and have an open invitation.
And certainly leadership development is the core of this trip. I guess, I mean, what do you hope to showcase to participants on that leadership edge?
I think it is always beneficial to get out of our comfort zone and yet to still experience people who are as dedicated to building community in the space that they live as we are in ours. And so there's a commonality in that. We all have similar purpose. We are just have slightly different dynamics, and obviously the places that we live are different. And so I think that there's just kind of this beautiful work that happens from a leadership standpoint, where people see those dynamics at work in their own community, in another community, and start to imagine how things can break from whatever situation that we are in here. So it empowers imagination. And I think that leaders need a goal to lead towards. So in leadership development, seeing some of these great stories from these other destinations inspires them to come home and find ways forward that can improve lives for people in Park City.
Okay. Well, we'll look forward to hearing from some of the class members once they return next spring. Anything else you wanted to tell us about the tour?
No, I'm really excited. This is, to clarify, this is my third. I went on one in class 29. We went to Fort Collins. Last year, like I said, we went to Reno, Tahoe, and Truckee. It is just an honor and so much fun to be able to take these trips and to experience these things with such a cross-section of our community. So I am beyond excited for this opportunity.
Okay. Leadership Class Director Scott Von Hartisfeld, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Leslie.
Following an anonymous tip, Utah water regulators are investigating whether contaminated water was dumped into a creek near the Park City School District Treasure Mountain Junior High demolition site. DEQ spokesperson Dave Noriega says the October 10th allegations were made through the agency's spills hotline.
We are actively investigating this situation, including the volume of water that may have been discharged into the creek, and then also the potential contaminants. We are not aware of any immediate public health or environmental risk from the alleged discharge, but we'll need to gather further information through our investigation.
In November, the same allegations were shared with Park City area media in an email from a concerned resident. The email claimed district contractors may have been illegally dumping water into a creek to the east of the school on and before October 10th. The district's contractor reports water was released into the creek, but only after tests showed it was not considered hazardous as defined by federal and state regulatory standards. Pump log records provided by the district also show water was discharged into the creek on only one day, October 10th. Almost 26,500 gallons were pumped into the creek over about 3 hours. On KPCW's Local News Hour, November 20th, Superintendent Lindsay Huntsman said the Department of Environmental Quality visits the project a couple of times a week on a staggered schedule to ensure compliance. The district has also had an environmental specialist on site throughout the project.
The certified environmental specialist has been on site every day, monitoring air quality, ensuring all work complies with state and federal requirements.
The DEQ says some findings from its investigation may be publicly available in late December or in early 2026. Prior to the water pumping allegations, the district also received a compliance advisory notice from the Division of Air Quality, alleging violations related to asbestos. Huntsman said the district was already taking corrective actions related to the mishandling of asbestos before the notice arrived. Board of Education Vice President Nick Hill also said issues related to asbestos are common in large-scale demolition projects.
It's important to note that like this stuff comes up because we are constantly testing and retesting. And as we do that, we revise the plan for that demolition. When something is uncovered like that, we'll pause in one area and we'll work in areas that we can until things are properly mitigated.
State regulators told KPCW asbestos-containing materials were removed before demolition continued. The Treasure Mountain demolition is part of the district's athletics master plan. Two soccer fields and eight tennis courts will be built in place of the school, and softball and baseball fields are under construction east of the building. Construction will continue as the weather allows. The district hopes to have Treasure Mountain torn down to the foundation before winter is in full swing. KPCW's Grace Dorfler sat down with the new man behind Deer Valley's ski map, Rad Smith. Here's what he learned from his mentor, James Niehues.
I'm KPCW's Grace Dorfler. Joining me today for an interview is Rad Smith. He is the map maker behind Deer Valley's new terrain map. Rad, good morning.
Good morning, Grace.
Thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you.
I guess to get started, I would love to hear a little bit about how one becomes a ski terrain map maker. How did you find your way to this path?
You know, that's a great question, and I'll try not to run on too long here, but it's been kind of a lifelong, you know, combination of events in my life and in my career that led to it. I was always a drawer and a painter as a young person, and I studied both fine arts and commercial art in college, kind of pursuing more of a graphic design path early on. And I always loved maps. I was attracted to National Geographic maps, and I loved weather maps and things like that as a young person. And I basically started a career in more in the environmental and cultural resource consulting world here in Bozeman, Montana, and worked for a firm that had an office here but did projects all over the world. And maps were always just a big part of my work, and infographics and things like that. And I continued to pursue my interest in maps through that work that I was involved in. And I wanted to get back more to painting as I got older, and I spent so much time on the computer and was getting a little tired of staring at a monitor, and I love to paint on my free time. And throughout my career, had become aware of James Niehues' work and his impact in the ski industry with his maps, and realizing that one person had been responsible for the bulk of the maps that had been created, at least in my lifetime. And the more I learned about his work and became just ultimately really attracted to that style, and I was doing a lot of three-dimensional digital illustrations for my maps at the time, and like I said, I really just wanted to get away from the computer. And I knew he was contemplating retiring, and you know, after a long career of painting hundreds and hundreds of maps throughout the world. So a number of years ago, I reached out to James and started a conversation with him, and he really encouraged me to pursue this, and that kind of led to where I'm at today.
And now, of course, you're getting a fair bit of attention for your map of the Deer Valley expansion, East Village. How long did it take you to make that map?
The painting itself took about 70 hours, but the whole process was more like 150 hours total, spread out over a number of months, 4 or 5 months total. I mean, I work on multiple projects at one time, but yeah, it's a long process that involves a lot of steps, and a lot of people were involved in helping me get the information correct. And yeah,
that's a lot of time. I hear that there's some aerial work that goes into getting ready to do the map painting. Do you go up in a plane? Do you send up a drone? What does that involve?
It kind of depends on the project. If I can get up in a plane, that's somewhat ideal, but with drone technology, I certainly rely on that a lot. as well. Really, the aerial imagery is critical. You know, I certainly utilize a lot of online mapping technologies and resources for an overview, but I try to do that sparingly and utilize as much photography, aerial imagery as I can to get, you know, those details correct and the hill shading and the tree densities and the buildings, the location of buildings and roads. I mean, ultimately, I really do try to rely on the aerial imagery as much as possible. For the Deer Valley map, I did not get up in a plane, unfortunately, but I was provided hundreds of images by Deer Valley, mostly drone imagery, but a lot of ground imagery as well.
Wow. For a landscape that large, how do you even start? What are the first steps?
You know, looking at both past maps and then looking at, they provided me with a lot of site plans and kind of showing the extent of the development over a number of years and trying to figure out how that fits in with the existing ski area. And again, I'm, you know, doing a lot of, initially there is a fair bit of computer work and bringing those maps in and draping them in something similar to like Google Earth and just seeing how things fit in and trying to figure out how high of a perspective I might need to take to make sure I capture the different, you know, aspects. And it's such a large area. I certainly had to take a much higher perspective than a more traditional map, which creates its own level of challenges and, you know, items that I need to kind of overcome and in order to develop a map that is both visibly appealing but also useful, you know, as a wayfinding tool.
What's the hardest part of making a map?
You know, each step has its challenges. I think the hardest part, you know, especially a map that size, is again, making sure that you're giving credit to the runs that need to be, you know, shown in the distance and that, you know, if they're falling kind of away from the viewer, you have to kind of bend that reality and still make it believable to the viewer. So it's something that they can identify as a place that they may know and love. So it really just, it's kind of like a puzzle and making sure all the pieces fit properly and that it's, you know, a believable image and making sure it's accurate.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like such a unique blend of precision with, you know, all the scientific aspects of the landscape and artistry with the painting. What was it like to learn from James Niehaus?
That's a good question. You know, really, I mean, James's work is just such a visual inspiration to me and to have his encouragement for me to pursue this. And boy, that's hard to put, really to describe how that feels, you know, just finding, you know, having conversations with him and learning more about some of the techniques he used. And it's just so invaluable. And also the painters that predate his work and some of the other panoramic painters and trail map painters, both here in the United States and in Europe, they have a long history of mountain panoramic painters. And it's pretty amazing to be in touch with someone that has that much talent and proficiency in the painting world. And it can be a little overwhelming because he sets such a high bar with his paintings and his trail map work. And it gives me something to constantly aim for and shoot for.
Yeah. What kind of paint do you use on the maps? Are they watercolors, oils, acrylics?
They are in large part opaque watercolors or gouache. Mm-hmm. I do use an acrylic paint for the skies or some areas that I want to be more permanent that I know I can, you know, come in and paint watercolors over. And the nice thing about the gouache is it's a really fast medium to work with. It dries really fast. It really started out as an illustrator's medium, and it's very vibrant, and you can come back and blend colors, and if there are mistakes or changes down the road, it's easy to remove the paint from the illustration board and repaint areas. So it's a fairly flexible medium in that sense. You know, mostly out of respect for time, you know, it's just a fast medium to work with.
That makes sense. Do you paint things besides ski maps?
Right now, no. I would like to. I shouldn't say that. I mean, I've painted other property, you know, in that ski map style. I've painted, you know, I've had private commissions for ranches and, you know, large pieces of property. And so I would like to, you know, get back to doing more painting for myself in a similar style. I mean, I think it would still kind of fall in that same category. I love the mountains and I love painting, you know, terrain. I love, you know, the more extreme terrain, the more fun it is to paint. So, but right now I'm just so focused on the trail maps and trying to fulfill those requests and keep up with that at this time.
That sounds like you're busy. Is it your full-time job?
It is now, yes. I left the consulting community in late 2020, 2021, and I've been drawing and painting maps of, I 90% of my work is trail maps and hand-painted maps. I still do some digital work for some clients I've had for a long time, but I've slowly transitioned to almost, you know, painting full-time now.
Wow. It's a really unique career path. One thing that I wonder about is, what do you see as the value of a hand-painted map rather than, you know, like you mentioned, there's a lot of technology now, like Google Earth and things like that. What does a hand-painted map offer that other ways of showing the landscape don't?
You know, first and foremost, I think it allows you to manipulate what you're looking at in the landscape to fit the needs of that mapping tool. I think it's harder to do that in the digital world, you know, with Google Earth or any kind of map information that's derived directly from real life data and it's not manipulated. Second to that, though, I think there's such a unique tradition in the ski industry and how they depict their areas. And, you know, it kind of gives a sense of there's kind of a timeless sense to hand-painted trail maps, and I think that often sits with, you know, the nostalgia that's felt at a ski area, and I think we're in this day and age, we're just so overwhelmed and bombarded with digital maps on our phones or on our computers, and they're great tools for, you know, getting around and finding, you know, where you're at and where you need to go on a road. But I think in the natural world, and you know, a hand-painted map has a more organic feel, just an overall look and feel that is a lot more in line with, you know, that experience of the ski area. I mean, we ski to be out in nature and to kind of get away from that digital world nowadays. So I think it's just something that people want to look at for a longer period, and it's kind of a treasure map and makes you want to go out and explore. And I don't know that we always get that with the digital maps in this day and age.
Yeah, I hear you. Is there anything unusual about the Deer Valley map that people with close eyes should look for this winter?
Well, you know, I mean, that's, Deer Valley is such a unique place in what they've, their expansion and what they've opened up, what they will be opening up with this year. I mean, that's just a massive leap in expansion. So I think those new runs and a lot of that new terrain around the East Village in large part is kind of a, you know, I think that's just what makes it unique. And it's such a large map, and to be able to see how this new terrain fits in with their existing terrain. And I don't really, you know, add any hidden items in there or anything like that, but they're, you know, I think it's just kind of an expanded treasure map that hopefully will allow people to get out there and explore all this new terrain and feel comfortable doing so.
Nice. Will you be able to come explore the terrain this winter at all?
I don't have a specific date on the calendar yet, but yes, I am planning to get down there this winter and spend some time at Deer Valley skiing.
Yeah, pick up a copy of your map.
I will, yeah. I will. And I'm planning to do another painting of that new terrain in a more traditional style. So I need to get down there and, you know, talk about that with some folks down there and get some more imagery and remind myself of how incredible that new terrain is.
Nice. How big is your painting itself that's then scaled down?
I typically paint a larger ski area like Deer Valley at 30 by 40 inches. Mm-hmm. Honestly, an area as big as Deer Valley, I could go larger, but that's kind of the largest. I paint on illustration board, and that's kind of the standard size of an illustration board. But with the amount of information and detail required in that landscape, I do wish I could, you know, I would love to paint it larger, but there are time constraints too with that.
That makes sense. Yeah. Well, Rad, thank you so much for telling me about your process of making these maps. It was great to hear about it.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate your interest in it.
We've been speaking with Rad Smith, who painted the expanded map of Deer Valley's terrain. Rad, thank you.
Thank you, Grace. I appreciate it.